Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
What happened the night Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez died?
There needs to be some rest. There needs to be some closure.
We follow the leads on Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We have breaking news. Governor Gavin Newsom is expected to formally announce in just a couple of minutes that California will lift most coronavirus restrictions on businesses and workplaces June 15th. The mask mandate will continue at that point, and the June 15th reopening is predicated on the vaccine supply being sufficient to get everybody vaccinated and that cases of COVID-19 stay low. Once again, Governor Newsom is expected within a couple of minutes to announce that California plans to lift most coronavirus restrictions on businesses and workplaces, largely reopening the California economy June 15th. However, a mask mandate will continue. We'll keep you updated on any further details coming from the governor's news conference in just a few minutes. But we turn our attention right now to Georgia. We also have breaking news about the All-Star game that was pulled out of Atlanta because of Major League Baseball's displeasure with new voting law in Georgia. Major League Baseball choosing Coors Field in Denver as the site of this year's MLB All-Star Game. Joining us from Atlanta is WABE Radio politics reporter Emma Hurt. Emma, thank you for joining us today on Air Talk.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's start with the baseball part of this, because we've just got the word confirmed from MLB that they are moving the All-Star Game to Denver. What has the local reaction been in the greater Atlanta area to the game being pulled?
Well, you know, I think it's a bipartisan agreement that this is not ideal. You know, that area is represented by Democrats, and they are unhappy about it just as much as the Republicans are. But the Republican disapproval has been a lot stronger because of the context of this voting law, right? They're defending it and arguing that the criticism of the law isn't based in fact, that people are misinterpreting the law. And, you know, I think broadly people are pointing out that, okay, you're doing this. Who's getting harmed by this? The Georgians who are employed at the stadium and the local economy there. So those are the people who are going to suffer the most out of this.
Are there concerns about further boycotts? You know, we're, of course, here, the film industry, TV production is such a big employer here. Are there any concern that this might affect the production economy in Georgia?
I mean, it's certainly a specter kind of hanging over what could be next, right? I think it was New Jersey offering to match Georgia's tax credits to try to attract some of the companies that are doing so much business here. And that, you know, that thought really scares a lot of people in the business community and again on both sides of the aisle, because the film and TV industries activities here in Georgia have had a massive impact on our economy, and it would be a huge, huge deal if some of that business were to move.
I was looking at the Washington Post's analysis of this controversial voting law in Georgia and the Post's conclusion that there are restrictions on voting that is going to make it likely more difficult for poorer voters, voters of color, to cast their ballots. But there are also ways at the same time that it expands voter access, particularly in rural areas of the state. And I wonder if you could just sort of hit the most important aspects of this bill and the ways that it's going to affect access in Georgia.
Yeah, you know, something that I've heard said a couple times about this law now is that it's basically a Rorschach test where you can find what you want, depending on what you're looking for in it. So, and it's nearly 100 pages long. And so there's a lot to look through. But I mean, you know, some of the headline provisions have been in addition of a new ID requirement for all absentee ballots replacing signature match. And so the argument is that adds a burden on voters who ordinarily would just sign a ballot to turn it in. There's, you know, new rules about absentee ballot drop boxes. And on the one hand, it codifies them into law. So they are now required in each county, at least one. That's new. Some counties did not have them at all this past year. But it also restricts how many there can be and restricts where they can be and what hours there can be open. And that's, those restrictions are new and they will have an effect on larger counties, especially those in Atlanta that really use drop boxes in this pandemic year of voting that we had to try to increase access. There is an expansion of early voting requirements, which won't really affect people in Metro Atlanta, where counties are already doing the most that they could do. But in smaller counties, you would see an expansion of voting access. And then, you know, another provision is the banning of food and drink. That's gotten a lot of attention because it bans handing out food or drink to someone who's standing in line within 25 feet of the line or within 150 feet of the polling place, except for self-service water stations set up by poll workers. And Republicans say this is to avoid any appearance of electioneering, even though it's already illegal to electioneer, to campaign at a polling place. But they say, look, you can set up your table and hand out all the stuff you want as long as you're 150 or 25 feet away. And so again, I mean, I could go on and on about this stuff, but there's a lot of detail and it cuts both ways.
We're talking with WABE politics reporter Emma Hurt. It's the NPR member station in the greater Atlanta area. If you have questions about the Georgia voting law, the controversy it's created, the claims that this will have a significant suppressing effect on African-American voters in Georgia, and a number of prominent American corporations who've gone on record, very rare for them to do that, in opposition to the law. Most demonstrably, Major League Baseball pulling the All-Star game from Atlanta and moving it to Denver. Emma, another huge part of this, of course, is that this is a Republican move, and it comes in the wake of former President Trump's allegations about Georgia voting, him asking the Secretary of State to find some votes that would enable him to win. And so there's not just explicitly what's in this bill, but the whole context of recent months that are around it. And can you talk a little bit about how that's made this even harder to go down with members of the public?
Absolutely. And I think that's really crucial in processing the feedback and the blowback that it's gotten. It's the timing that looks really bad, you know, some would argue, to Republicans, because there's two layers of it. There's the fact that Georgia Republicans had some major losses in 2020 in Georgia after solid control of the state for decades. They lost the presidential race and the Senate races. And so messing with the election code makes people suspicious. Are you trying to, you know, make sure that you don't lose any more in the future? Are you trying to cook the books? And Republicans, of course, vehemently deny that. But then there's the other layer that you alluded to of President Trump's really fixation on Georgia's elections in the past few months, arguing without evidence that there was fraud, and really sowing this doubt among a lot of Republican voters around the country, but especially in Georgia. And we saw an effect with Republican voters staying home in the January runoffs, and many assume because they don't believe the system was working accurately. And so this law, some say, is a response to that. And the argument is, why are you doing that? This, there was no proof of widespread fraud. So why, you know, what's the need? There is no need for this law. And Republicans would argue that there is a need for changes to make elections run better as we've ramped up absentee voting. And then, you know, Georgia did see a lot of lines in June and there was a lot of attention there. And so they argue they're trying to address some of those problems as well. They're not mentioning the fraud in their description about the law, but that context is important, as is, really quickly, I just want to add, you know, Georgia's history, the South's history with overt voter suppression that, you know, culminated in the civil rights movement. I mean, you can't separate that history from what's happening. However much Republicans have really, really rejected that characterization and say that it's completely not fair, not a fair comparison. That is how a lot of people are describing it on the other side of the issue.
Again, Delta and Coke, two other Atlanta-based companies that have come out with statements strongly criticizing the Georgia election law. Do you know how that's been received within those companies? Because they're significant employers in the Atlanta area.
Yeah. I mean, those were really surprising statements to come so forcefully against the law, you know, days after it had been passed. These companies have lobbyists at the Capitol, and they said, and the people who wrote the bill, Republicans who wrote the bill, have said that everyone was at the table. You know, they were involved as this was being debated. And Republicans felt kind of betrayed by this, these strong statements last week, because they said, hey, guys, we were all there talking and you didn't say anything about how upset you were about it. And now you're upset and now you're going to make a big deal of it. And actually, we saw an attempted retaliation by some state House Republicans who passed a bill that would have removed Delta's fuel tax break. It was the same day as those statements came out, and the Senate didn't ultimately take it up, so it didn't become law. But it was kind of a warning shot, and you know, even Republican lawmakers were joking about drinking Pepsi instead of Coke. I mean, that's like sacrilegious in Georgia to this point. So it's been dramatic, the response.
Yeah. Emma, thank you very much. Really appreciate your reporting, what's happening and the complexity of the response within the state and within the greater Atlanta area. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Larry. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Politics reporter for NPR member station in Atlanta, WABE. Also with us is associate professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis, Travis Crum. Professor Crum, we appreciate your being with us and talking about your scholarship in the area of voting rights. Your thoughts on the Georgia bill and what its most significant impact will be. In what area do you see that?
Thanks for having me on, Larry. I would agree with a lot of what your other NPR correspondent, Emma, was talking about in terms of this bill in some ways being a Rorschach test. In some parts of the bill, it's making it easier to vote. In other parts of the bill, it's making it harder to vote. The thing I do want to focus on that actually worries me the most, and it might be one of the harder aspects of the bill to challenge, is that the bill has taken powers away from the Secretary of State. And if you recall back late last year and early this year, Brad Raffensperger was under a lot of pressure from President Trump to help find 11,000 extra votes. And this bill takes power away from the Secretary of State and gives more power to the state legislature, and also makes it easier for the state to exert control over county boards of elections. And so when we're, as election law scholars and lawyers, thinking about kind of nightmare scenarios in the future of when you have a very close election and worries about political subversion, that type of move should raise some red flags. And that's the part of the bill that really concerns me.
And how do other states handle that? Is that atypical to give that much authority to the legislature as opposed to local county officials or an elected secretary of state?
So one of the things that's so unique about American electoral systems is how much control politicians have over them and how decentralized it is. Almost every other advanced democracy in the world gives these types of responsibilities to nonpartisan actors or technocrats or bureaucrats. Here in the U.S., it is far more common to see this type of control by elected officials. Now, it really varies by states as to whether or not it's at the county level level or kind of housed in the Secretary of State's office or sometimes even the Attorney General's office or the state legislature. There's you know, kind of 50 different models out there as to how this power is divvied up.
Well, and given this recent history of the pressure on the Secretary of State and all, is that part, and of course the history of voter suppression in Georgia, is that what makes this much more controversial here than that model in other parts of the country?
I think so. And to kind of elaborate on something that Emma said, you know, prior to 2013, Georgia was called a covered jurisdiction under the Voting Rights Act. It had to seek federal pre-approval for any voting change. And this is the type of voting change that would have been looked at pretty hard by the Attorney General, because Georgia would have had the burden to prove that the law was not enacted with discriminatory intent. It would not have a retrogressive effect on minority voting rights. And there's a lot of evidence here, both in terms of what's motivating the passage of the bill and its likely impact on minority communities, that it would not have been pre-cleared. And so I think given that history and the fact that, you know, just 8 years ago, this law might not have been able to be passed. And if it was passed, it probably would have had some of its rougher edges shorn off. I think that also is cause for concern.
And is this law susceptible to constitutional legal challenge?
So there are two primary ways to challenge these types of election laws. And here I want to focus on some of the challenges that have already been filed alleging that this law is voter suppression. And so one legal avenue is to say that the law is racially discriminatory. You can prove that either by showing intent, showing that the law was designed to hurt minority voters, or you can show discriminatory effects, showing that it has a disproportionate impact on minority voters. And on that second part, the Supreme Court is hearing a case this very term, and a decision is expected in June, where it's going to provide a new standard for how to adjudicate these types of claims under the Voting Rights Act. And we're going to have to wait and see what the standard is in that case to really get a grip on any legal challenge to this new Georgia law. And then the second kind of avenue to challenge is not a race-based challenge, but a right-to-vote challenge under the 14th Amendment. And under that area of law, states are given a lot of deference in designing their electoral schemes and making it, you know, easier or harder to vote. And the Supreme Court said in a 2008 opinion called Crawford versus Marion County Election Board that states don't need any recent evidence of voter fraud to pass election integrity measures. And that precedent has made it quite difficult to challenge these types of laws on a non-race-based 14th Amendment claim.
Now, we also have the recently passed bill in the House of Representatives, which would put much more of the election process under federal control. It's got a tough go in the U.S. Senate. But let's say hypothetically that bill that comes from Democrats in the House was to be passed and signed into law. Would that have any effect on the new Georgia law?
So I think some of the most important aspects of the For the People Act that you're referring to focus more on gerrymandering redistricting reform. There are some aspects of it that are targeting what we're talking about here in Georgia, kind of first-generation problems. But one thing to kind of keep in mind is that these types of reforms at the federal level can only regulate federal elections when Congress is kind of stepping in and using its elections clause authority. The reforms that are being considered in the future that might be better targeted what's going on in Georgia, that's the John Lewis Voting Rights Restoration Act. And some of the reforms in that package, I think, could really be helpful in kind of combating these types of laws passed in Georgia and elsewhere in recent years.
Thank you so much, Professor. Really appreciate your analysis of the Georgia voting law recently passed by the Republican legislature there, which has led to corporations issuing statements in opposition and Major League Baseball moving its All-Star game from Atlanta to Denver. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
From Washington University in St. Louis, College of Law Associate Professor Travis Crum. He researches and teaches voting rights, race, and federalism. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, and we have breaking news in case you just joined us. Governor Gavin Newsom says California will lift most coronavirus restrictions on businesses and workplaces on June 15th. State officials saying enough people should be vaccinated by then to allow for life to almost get back to a pre-pandemic normal. The mask mandate will stay in effect, but California is looking at essentially reopening June 15th, provided, and two big provisions, that vaccine supply is sufficient for everybody who wants to be vaccinated to be fully vaccinated by June 15th. And secondly, that the case rate stays low enough that everything can safely reopen June 15th. We'll be back on Air Talk and take a look at whether vaccines should be mandatory for students and faculty returning to colleges and universities. What do you think? We're at 866-893-KPCC.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.